Well, moving into our next guest, we have Jay Belts, a founding partner and managing consultant of Integrity Pension Services, LLC. He is the managing consultant and founding partner, and his company strives to provide the highest quality retirement plan services with high touch, and they are actively engaged to take care of their clients' needs as a service-oriented retirement plan consulting firm. It's growing, looking for excellent retirement plan administration and consultants. If you have the requisite skills to provide the high-quality service in this field, please email Jay. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason, and hello to you, Scott.
How are you doing today? I know you're down in a little bit warmer country than Vegas, so how's Arizona today?
I am in the Valley of the Sun in Phoenix, Arizona, and you know, hearing you guys talk about the weather there, it is spectacular here. It's mid to upper 70s, a bit cloudy, but I am parked right now between Camelback Mountain and Piestewa Peak, and the hills are green from all the recent rainfall. It's just beautiful.
Wow, that's amazing. I know we got some green along our freeways, but it's not what you'd really like to see because it's grass and weeds, so... Because we had a little bit of rain, too. But, I love Camelback Mountain. There's some great stuff around there to do. All my cousins live in Mesa, so we spent a lot of time in that area when I was a kid.
And the really cool thing here is the sunsets are just amazing, and we should have that tonight with this cloud, with these clouds, in about an hour or so. So, you know, Arizona does not change on to daylight saving time or off it, so... right now, we're an hour ahead of you there in Las Vegas.
I know that because I always get confused when I leave messages from my brother. So he lives in Arizona, so I always forget when I'm calling him late at night. It's already too late to talk to him, so it's a different story.
I'm sure he reminds you of that.
Yes, he does. So tell us what's on your plate right now in the financial market and retirement world. What is the hot buttons right now?
You know, hearing you guys talk about those new IRS forms, it reminds me, IRS added questions on the annual Form 5500 that retirement plans file. But there was a lot of feedback negative to those questions, so they made them optional, which is kind of strange. And just last week, it actually may have been Monday of this week, the Department of Labor came out and they said, do not answer them. Just absolutely. They're not optional. Don't answer them.
Weirdly. I mean, they are on the form, but they're not supposed to be answered.
Correct. So when we send out returns now, we're telling each of our clients, these item numbers are intentionally left blank. They're not to be answered this year. We believe they're going to be required next year. So we'd already filed some with those questions answered, but you know, no harm, no foul type of situation.
So what's the magic about those questions? What kind of questions are they? What makes them so hard?
They were starting to dig into some things they only would dig into before really on audit, meaning they asked some very specific questions about how you comply with certain parts of the retirement plan rules, that the returns in the past were more informational in nature, and these were and are more compliance-oriented.
Sounds like some of those tax firms that Jason and I have probably looked at when they wanted to basically have you report some of the, you know, more aggressive positions on a tax return if you had certain dollar amounts of income. So, you know, sort of lay it out on the table for the IRS.
Yeah.
Say, hey, this is what we've got reported on this tax return, so come look at it.
Right.
So the unreported items.
Mm-hmm.
So very similar.
And, you know, the president, I guess, recently put out his annual budget. And some things there in the retirement plan area have not changed, more like a wish list, if you will. They're not going to pass, though, because of Congress. And some of them we just don't think are good rules. One of those is to put an artificial cap on the amount that you can save in total between your IRAs and any tax-qualified plan, like a 401k plan.
Oh, wow.
And once you reached an amount that... they deem to be appropriate, then you could not add any more to any of your accounts. Now, if it dropped below that level because of bad investments, let's say, then you could add back to it, but only up to the cap again.
Wow.
And the reason why the cap is not known, it's actually the lump sum equivalent of an annual amount that you would need at age 65 to retire on. So it's $210,000 a year, which is a pretty good number, which ties into the maximum benefit you can earn under a defined benefit plan.
So it's like the backwards calculation, like the required minimum distributions, but just in the value side of it, kind of?
That's right, Scott. Yeah, it's the exact opposite. So it's how much you could accumulate. Interesting, though, with as you guys were talking about the presidential election, you know, all of these rules will come into play depending upon who our next president is.
Wow.
And how is that?
Well, it's really important, as we all know, as to who our next president is going to be. You look at the different agendas for each one. You know, you guys mentioned Bernie Sanders, for example. You know, he's going to, without question, as he says, raise taxes for a number of things. So when that happens, and in general when tax rates go up, retirement plans become more valuable, because people want that deduction, right? We all don't want to pay more than our fair share of taxes. Another proposal, though, under Obama right now would actually cap your deduction at a certain percentage. So regardless of which tax bracket your last dollar is in, you can only get a 28-cent deduction.
Oh, that's simplification of the tax rules, isn't it? Oh, my goodness. I haven't heard that before.
I don't know how that form is going to look. You know, it's going to be interesting as to how you... Yeah, another schedule, Scott, that you have to fill out to determine your deduction. So that's why I meant, Jason, depending upon who the next president is, these items that Obama keeps putting forward will either go on or they'll go away.
Yeah, I can kind of see a careful analyzing effect of what people can put in maximally during the year, but if that maximum works and you're covering your employees under ERISA and you're, you know, compensating the highly compensated and the rank and file employee, that should be just fine.
It should be. And it is a bit frustrating, as you pick up on my tone on this. Actually, when some of these proposals come out every year, I immediately write a check and send it off to the ASPA PAC, because they represent retirement plan administrators like myself across the country. And they do, you know, talk to legislators and, you know, make sure they know our agenda as well. And it is exactly that. We believe these are sound principles for investing for the future and for saving for the future through tax preferred vehicles like retirement plans. And when you're covering your employees and you're looking out for their welfare, you know, why shouldn't you get your fair share as well?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of budget proposals, you know, these things that come out every year, but a lot of them are just kind of die on the vine because they don't go anywhere. But one of the things that came out with Obama's budget is to increase ways people can have access to retirement plans. I mean, this like automatic enrollment to individual retirement accounts, for example. Do you think those would do any good?
They do good at only the base level. Let's say, and I mean by that, someone who can't afford to save more than, say, $1,000 or $2,000 a year, because it's just simple and it's easy. Because remember, we can all save in retirement plans right now in IRAs, but only about 17% of us actually do so. So they're trying to make that part automatic through your employer. You know, because if they deduct it, you don't see it, you can't spend it. And I like that idea. What they're also doing, Jason, is they have been giving favor lately to state-sponsored retirement plans. And they kind of got themselves caught in a trap here, because they said that states could sponsor multiple employer plans, where previously they did not let the private sector do that. And so, you know, the arms went up and the voices were raised and said, hey, you know, how can they do it as a state when we can't do it in the private sector? So they said, oh, well, no, you can do it now in the private sector. So they got caught up in that, and we'll see that a bit more, I think, in the next coming years. And the reason why employers would go to that plan is that they could share some expenses. So, for example, if your plan requires an accounting audit because you have more than 100 participants, then if, let's say, the three of us joined our large companies together, we would only need to have one audit. We could share that expense. You know, as to how much savings that actually is, I'm not quite sure, but that's the concept, to have some expense sharing.
In your review of pension information, I mean, you've got to see statistics, I would think, as far as what the generations have available for retirement, and let's just say if you're in a 20s or you're in a younger generation, I mean, are they on trend to retire or have enough to retire based on their habits now?
That's a great question, Jason. And actually, what all the evidence shows is that it is the millennials and even those younger who actually are saving very well today. There's a lot of us, you know, maybe in the 40s and 50s that didn't do that well when we were younger. And, you know, we have that catch-up contribution now. When you're age 50 or better, you can use that. And, you know, the purpose of that, obviously, was the fact that we're not naturally very good savers. And that was the opportunity to catch back up. But they're doing a good job these days at the younger generation in saving, because they see all these issues that are so prevalent in today's economy, and they know nobody knows about tomorrow. And so they're recognizing that, I think, at an earlier age, and are saving better because of it.
We have Jay Belts on the line with us. He'll be back in a couple minutes. We're going to take a break. Jay, we'll be back in a few minutes.
Yo ho, yo ho, a pirate's life for me. We pillage, we plunder, we rifle and loot. Drink up, me hearties, yo ho. We kidnap and ravage and don't give a hoot. Drink up, me hearties, yo ho.
Hey, isn't this a great song? And we're doing this in reverence to Jay Belch, who is our crusader of 401k plans, calling in from Arizona. And welcome back, Jay.
Thank you, Jason. I am the 401 crusader.
How did you like that yo-ho song?
I was excited about that.
Yeah.
I thought, is this not a commercial? But no, it was better than a commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but I've heard that song so many times in my life. I
have you been on the Pirates of Caribbean ride a few times
with your
kids?
Many, many times.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, I wanted to point out, while I have just a few minutes here, that we are 3.5 weeks away approximately from March 15th. And that is a deadline for many tax purposes. The one that I'm talking about now, though, is for Section 401k plans. You know, those plans have to perform an annual non-discrimination test with respect to the salary deferrals. And the reason that is because Congress said these plans are not just for the highly compensated. They should be broad-based. And so the rules potentially limit the amount of funding that the highly compensated can fund into those plans unless their employees are also playing along. So a lot of those plans today, they buy out of that test, or they get around the test by using a safe harbor. And a safe harbor contribution is allocated primarily to the non-highly compensated employees. So it makes the plan broad-based, even in the situation where the employees are not themselves savings.
What is that? Now, what is that safe harbor percentage?
It's two different types, Jason. There's an across-the-board or non-elective, which is 3% of pay. And we treat this as if the employee was deferring their salary, even though the employer funded it. So it's fully vested, and it has all the characteristics that it would have if the employee put their own money in the plan. And alternatively, you can do a matching contribution. And it's a twofold for the minimum. It's 100% match of the first 3% of pay that the employee did actually defer, plus 50% of the next two, for a total of 4%. So what some employers do and some plans we design, we make it easier. We just say it's 100% match on the first 4% of salary that you defer. So if an employee does not defer their salary, then there's no required matching contribution. So obviously it's an incentive, and we always hear financial planners and others who give investment advice tell us, if your employer has a plan with a match, fund at a minimum the amount to get the full match, right? So in this case, you would fund at least 4% of your salary to get that 4% match.
Now, Jason, just to clarify a little bit, that testing that you're talking about is due March 15th. That is what generates the 1099-R, which has that excess contribution number that typically comes on it for the prior year, because it kind of falls in that test category right after the end of the year. Is that what usually generates
the
piece of paper?
That's exactly what we're talking about, Scott. You're exactly right. They're called excess contributions because that plan did not meet what's called the ADP test, or the average deferral percentage test. So certain highly compensated employees, and we'll define that in a minute, they get money back that they deferred in the prior year. They are taxed on it when they receive it. So that's a nice little break versus having to go back to the prior year, which used to be the case, by the way, until you know the lobby got around to telling Congress, come on, let's make it a bit easier, you know, because people had to amend returns and so forth. So let's go through an example. Let's say that I funded the maximum amount that the law says I can, which is $18,000 for each one of us, as long as we make at least that much. But under my employer's plan, there wasn't enough participation. So I can only put in, by these rules, $15,000. So I have an excess contribution of $3,000 that comes back to me. I do get a 1099, and it's taxable in the year I receive that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I remember.
If we don't return those monies by March 15th, that's that coming up deadline now, 3.5 weeks, then the employer has to pay a 10% excise tax for being late.
Ah.
So a lot of this testing is going on right now because, you know, nobody likes to pay a penalty.
Yeah, that's true.
So can I, let's say you're a highly compensated employer and you have a 401k plan now. Can the employer just elect out and not be in the plan, and then that would take care of that issue?
Absolutely, Jason. So highly compensated employees, let's define that. That's people who in the prior year made at least $120,000 of earnings. It's also anyone who has more than 5% ownership in the plan sponsor for the current year or the prior year. So even one day of ownership would make you highly compensated. Now, they don't have to participate. And the discrimination rules are only so that the highly compensated don't participate to a greater extent than anybody else, or to an exclusive extent. So in the example where you have an owner who doesn't really care to participate in the plan, and he's the only highly compensated employee, you don't have a test because there are not any highly compensated employees who are in the plan. Now, curiously, the opposite's also true. If you only have highly compensated, say you have a husband and wife who have their own company, they're self-employed, they're both highly compensated because they both are considered to own the company, but they don't have employees, there's no discrimination testing. They are deemed to automatically pass all of those rules.
So let me ask you a question. I mean, this happens quite a lot with businesses. You have a buy-sell arrangement, so you have someone who's gone sort of semi-retirement mode, but they still make a pretty good salary, and they're already 70 and a half, so they're taking their required minimum distributions. They're part of that test, right? Because they're highly compensated. They're over 120,000, and that could cause tainting of the numbers to the rest of the highly compensated, couldn't it?
It could, Scott, but it can also help. So it depends if that person is deferring their salary or not, or if that person wants to receive a maximum profit-sharing contribution or not. So sometimes you have someone in that category who, let's say they've been able to save a lot of money over the years, and they don't need to save any more. They then are part of the test, and mathematically they're a zero in the test. They could help out others who want to save, say the younger owners. So you see that a lot of times, let's say, with professional firms, you know, a law firm or an accounting firm, where you have a very broad range of owners. You know, you might have some young partners who are in their 30s and others who could be in their mid to late 70s or older. And the older guys perhaps don't need to defer, don't want to save any more money. But the younger guys sure do. And they can come together and average those out. It really depends upon the situation.
In that example, if that 75-year-old guy who makes over $120,000 a year doesn't participate in the plan, that doesn't hurt the computation. But if he participates at a smaller amount, it could. Is that what you're getting to?
It could. Okay. But it helps out if he does not participate or only participates to a minimum or minimal level.
Okay.
If he maximizes, he's not helping anybody.
Okay. That's good to know. Because that happens a lot with the buy-sells and when people are in the rank and file starting to retire and coming into buying out the senior guys. It's interesting.
Yeah. You know, here's what also happens, though, in that situation you just mentioned. Say you are the partner that's early 70s and you just got bought out. So you don't have any more ownership. And maybe per your agreement, you actually are no longer an employee. But, you know, we want his help for a while. Perhaps we enter into a contract to hire his services for a two-year period. So now he's an independent contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And now he can have his own separate retirement plan for his independent contractor income for those 2 years.
Yeah, and that's not like disallowed when you're based on your age. You know, that's, I thought, was interesting. But you can't have an IRA if you're 70, right? You can't do that.
Yeah, that's the difference, JT. Yeah, you can no longer fund an IRA after 71 half.
Yeah.
But you can start a retirement plan at any age. In fact, we put a plan in last year. It's going to be a five-year program for a gentleman who's 72.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's got a nice contract with a firm for 5 years, which is, you know, a six-figure contract. And he would like to save as much as possible of that and not pay current tax on it.
Sure.
So
I have a question for you, Jay. It's come up in my mind with a few clients recently that are now at the RMD stage, which is their required minimum distribution. A few years back when the market was dropping significantly, there was a change in the calculation that was passed down from, I'm not sure if the DOL did or Congress or whatever, they let you recalculate that. Is that going to happen coming up soon? Have you heard any discussion on that?
No, I haven't heard anything new. They went to a more of a uniform table that actually gave us all a bit more longer to live.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of that is that required minimum distribution calculation produced lower amounts.
Okay.
So you didn't have to take out quite as much. It's generally about 4% a year that you take out when you turn age 70 and one half.
So that means you got about 20-something, 24 years in your life, they think, anyways?
Quite a long time.
Yeah, obviously that's an average. It's per the mortality tables. And, you know, it's across all of us via that law of large numbers, it's called. So
yeah, and if the market continues to go down, they're not gonna have anything if they live past 90.
Well, that could be, you know, part of your retirement program.
You know, one thing I'd like to mention, you know, this is an important point, but they made it permanent that, you know, you can take, if you're a 70 and a half, 71 and a half person, they have a pension plan, you can actually direct transfer $100,000 from your pension plan to a charity. A lot of people have a lot of money that is going to go to charity, and people really have a great advantage to take advantage of that provision now. Direct transfer now permanent to charity.
That's a good reminder, Jason, because that is a big, big deal, because some of these people at that age maybe don't itemize that much. Their house is paid off. They don't do a whole lot of real estate taxes on their house. They might not have a whole lot of itemized deductions. So
yeah,
it changes their tax position very significantly.
Now, does that go into the required minimum distribution calculation, Jay? I'm not sure.
No, it comes out.
Okay.
Because when you do the calculation, you look at the prior year's account balance. And when that money's gone, that account balance is now lower by the distribution, resulting in a lower required distribution.
So you basically, it does reduce like the total amount that's in the plan that is then used to compute what that required minimum distribution is, but it doesn't like reduce
right,
it by,
right.
It doesn't reduce direct, it by $100,000 net
deduction that
dollar.
Year. Okay. Correct. Yeah, okay. It just comes into play in the calculation. So.
So, where can they find you, Jay? We're coming up close to the end of your spot here. Give us the listeners your contact information.
Well, thanks, Jason. Our website is integritypension.com, and on there we do list a lot of valuable information. These shows are all on there as well when I'm a participant here, and we are 800 number is 800. Boy, I'm thinking of our fax number all of a sudden out of the blue. It'd be funny if I gave everybody our fax number to call.
Uh-huh.
We're 800-652-7067. It's one of those numbers you don't call yourself very often, so you don't think about it. But 800-652-7067. My email is jaybeltz at integritypension.com.
Great.
Glad to have you on the show today, Jay, as our monthly guest, and hop back on that Pirate of the Caribbean ride as we depart.
Scott, Jason, thank you both. Have a great weekend.
Okay, you too. All right, talk to you soon. Thanks, Jay. We'll be back right after the break. This is Financial Fridays.